Crime Obscene is a monthly true crime podcast. This episode contains information of crimes involving children. Listener discretion is advised. On the night of the 1st of November 2007, Jalique Rainwalker was last seen by his adoptive father. When Stephen Kerr woke up the next morning, Jalique was nowhere to be seen. With his bed made up to apparently look like he was sleeping, Stephen realized his son was gone and would report Jalique missing to the police. When the police arrive, Stephen informs them that a duffel bag, a stuffed animal that belonged to his adopted son, and some clothes were missing. And most harrowing of all, a note is found, seemingly written by the 12-year-old, stating he was leaving. But what looks from the outset as a runaway child soon spirals down a much sinister path. Both family and loved ones of Jalique insist he had not run away, and the investigation soon turns into a suspected murder with none other than his adopted parents in the spotlight. In this week's episode, we uncover the suspicious vanishing of 12-year-old Jalique Rainwalker, a young boy who from his very birth had trial after trial levelled at him. We uncover the information from the day he was reported missing, true to the avenues of investigation that led police to looking closer to home in his disappearance. Hello, welcome to Crime Obscene. I'm your host, Aaron. Before we begin, I would like to thank everyone for your wonderful feedback on the first episode released last month. As this is a new venture, I'm constantly looking to improve this podcast and make the best content as possible for these cases. If you have any thoughts, queries, or would like to submit a case suggestion, you can do so at crimeobscenepod@outlook.com, tweet me at crimeobscenepod, or DM me on Instagram at the same name. You can listen to Crime Obscene on all your favourite podcatchers. Now, let's begin. Jalique L. Rainwalker was born on August 2nd, 1995, in Albany, New York. Having spent the first 9 months of his life in utero, exposed to drugs and alcohol. Just 2 days after his birth, he was put up for adoption. The effects of his prenatal experiences would influence his entire life. Jalique was diagnosed with reactive attachment disorder, which made it hard for him to form relationships, which developing babies and young children need to feel loved and nurtured. He also had a speech impediment, which would make his R's sounds come out as W. Over the years, Jalique spent much of his childhood through 6 foster homes, settling for a time in the 6th home with Jody and Larry Schoen, and all seemed well. The last complex emotional problems Jalique had, stemming back to his childhood, would put a strain in the home. While the Schoens found Jalique a very bright and intelligent boy, he often erupted in severe temper tantrums and sometimes violent outbursts. So when Jalique was 7 and attacked his young foster sister, that prompted them to make the difficult decision to give Jalique away. This would be where Jalique would live up until his disappearance in 2007, in the care of Stephen Kerr and wife Jocelyn McDonald. His new adoptive family had 3 sons of their own and a previously adopted daughter, so it would seem they were a perfect fit for each other. However, his new family had a very non-traditional life. Their home had no running water. Everyone slept in the one room. The toilets were outhouses, and electricity came from an on-site generator that ran for some hours throughout the day. Uncomfortable conditions for someone like Jalique, who needed a particular set of conditions for his emotional problems. Chapter 1. Crime Timeline. To understand the events of the crime, first we must understand the life and tribulations of Jalik. Jalik knew from a young age what hardship was. Born addicted to cocaine, and being adopted 2 days after birth was only the start. Throughout his childhood, Jalik was reported to have explosive temper tantrums, so severe it would scare his foster siblings and the parents alike. This would unfortunately mean Jalik went through several foster homes before he was 7. Unlike most children, because of his emotional issues, Jalik was put into what was called therapeutic foster care. This differed from regular foster care because it was only granted to parents who specialized in the type of care a child like Jalik needed. Jody and Lawrence Schoen were the longest home to care for Jalik, and they beamed brightly about how intelligent he was. And when he was old enough to read, it was said he could go through a book a day. He loved running, playing soccer, and even had a love for dinosaurs, which the Schoens delighted in, buying him tons of dino toys. By all accounts, Jalik was a very sweet and loving boy, and for the 4 years the Schoens cared for him, they loved him truly. But for the Schoens, Jalik's tempers would begin to slowly put a strain on their ability to care for him, and over the years, try as they might, hour-long tantrums would soon manifest in violence, and one day he attacked one of their younger daughters. The Schoens genuinely cared and loved Jalik, but once he became a potential danger to the other children, they had to act. Making the very hard decision, Jody and Lawrence decided to not go forward with the adoption, and despite concerns for what might happen to Jalik in other homes and situations beyond, they felt it was the right thing to do. In 2002, Jalik was placed in his final foster home in Greenwich, New York, and one from the onset appeared to be a match made in heaven. Greenwich, in stark contrast to the state's capital of Albany, had a small population, and Stephen Kerr and Jocelyn MacDonald were conservative, environmentally concerned people. They seemed to care and felt duty-bound to live as friendly to the environment as possible. They had 3 biological sons and 1 adopted daughter, who reportedly had the need of therapeutic care as well. Jalik would fit in perfectly. In the early years, things seemed to be working out well. Kerr and MacDonald would finalise full adoption of Jalik, and from the outside it was though everything was working out. But somewhere between being officially adopted and Jalik's final night, things would slowly change. Over the years, the adopted family states he was increasingly becoming difficult. They reported he had made both suicidal and homicidal statements. It would be worth mentioning that some of these statements cannot be verified, as it is the say of the family and not documented, because at no point during these difficult times did MacDonald or Kerr bring Jalik to get counselling or medical help. October 23rd, 2007. Stephen appears strongly anxious and upset. He calls a crisis hotline and is put through to a crisis worker. He expresses his wish to reverse the adoption, stating they cannot manage to raise Jalik anymore. Jalik is homeschooled, and according to Stephen, he threatened to rape a child in the homeschool group. This was the last straw, and Jocelyn MacDonald, now fearful of Jalik, wanted him gone from the home. The crisis worker tells Stephen the adoption is concrete and cannot be reversed, and suggested respite care. For those who may not know, respite care is a situation where when things are a little too much for family or adopted child alike, they can be placed in temporary care of another foster family for an agreed period of time, so both parties can cool down, and so the child can work through whatever issues they have and come back refreshed, and the parents can do similarly. Respite periods are only temporary. The family agreed to this, and Jalik is sent to the home of Elaine and Tom Pearson, who are licensed foster parents and had provided respite for him before. This arrangement would last until the 1st of November, where Jalik would then be brought to another respite home the next day. During the period he was with the Pearsons, it has been said that Jalik was content and was excited to be there with them. The Pearsons had a very good history fostering children, Stephen had fostered a child with reactive attachment disorder before, so could envisage the challenge it represented, but they were very fond of Jalique. Elaine Pearson was even quoted in saying that Jalique's current adoptive parents, quote, were unable to parent him, end quote. At the end of Jalique's stay, Kerr came to collect him and would move him to the next respite home. This next home would never receive him, however. Kerr brought his adoptive son to his parents' home in Greenwich, as Jocelyn and the kids still did not want Jalique near them, so this was to be a one-night arrangement before moving on the next morning. Kerr states that on the night of October 31st, 2007, he and Jalique had dinner. A manager and waitress at a Red Robin restaurant in Latham recalled seeing the two eating dinner around 8 p.m. that night, and then they returned home. He put him to bed. Nothing was out of ordinary, according to Kerr, input interview audio here. When Kerr awoke the next morning, however, at 7:30 a.m, he found the bed empty of Jalique, but was apparently made up to look like somebody was sleeping with pillows pushed up to form a sleeping silhouette under the blanket. After an hour of frantic searching, Kerr states he then calls the police at 8:57 a.m. As police take notes and learn of Jalique's emotional problems, they assume it is a simple case of runaway. Kerr reports the duffel bag and Jalique's stuffed animal to be missing, though these would be located in the garage later on. Of all the signs of Jalique's whereabouts, most damning of all was a note supposedly written by the 12-year-old. The note read, quote, "Dear everybody, I'm sorry for everything. I won't be a bother anymore. Goodbye, Jalique," end quote. We will return to the note later. Chapter 2, The Search, The Note, The Letter. Quickly, police take action, and a search begins. Media attention follows in suit. Before long, the community, any agency that could, and even previous foster carers would unite in the search. Notably, the Pearsons and the Showans were very worried about Jalique. The location Jalique was last seen in was a rather remote area. Along with being in the woods, it was November, and the weather would certainly be cause for concern. Jalique seemingly left with just the clothes he was last in, a bright yellow fleece pullover, a grey t-shirt with the image of a dragon on the front, blue jeans, and black canvas high-top sneakers, not very winter-friendly. The search consisted of ground search with tracking dogs. Helicopters would survey from above with infrared cameras, but no trace could be found. As a young boy still in school, Jalique had no job or source of income, so police could not track financial records, and he did not have a cell phone. With no clear indications to the young boy's location, police scaled back their search and began interviewing those closest to Jalique. Coupled with some inconsistencies with Stephen Kerr's accounts for that night, police began interviewing McDonald and Kerr. Initially, investigators found them to be cooperative, seeing them even participate in the search, but this fizzled out soon, and after they found them to be evasive in answering questions. The biggest grounds for suspicion surrounding Kerr's recollection of the night of October 31st comes from the fact that police dived into phone records of Kerr, and whilst he had given a very detailed route of the trip from the Pearsons to the home in Greenwich, police would discover Kerr had taken a detour to an area south Troy, approximately 30 miles away. A person who had been on the phone with Kerr that night claimed to notice he was agitated on the call. Concerned by the misleading information by Kerr, police would ask McDonald and Kerr to take a polygraph test. McDonald took one and passed, but unsurprisingly, Kerr shot down this request. It would be worth stating that polygraph tests are not admissible in court and are used as an investigative tool and cannot really be used to determine a person's guilt conclusively. Investigations continued, and the more police dug while trying to nail down Kerr's shaky timeline, they discovered more suspicious activity. Surveillance footage of Glen Falls National Bank in Greenwich shows a van matching Kerr's van drive by at 12 a.m., the time that he claims he and Jalique are asleep. and while investigators could not say definitively it was Kerr's vehicle, they believed it was. Apart from inconsistencies and misleading information as to his whereabouts, no solid evidence could be ascertained as to Jalik's faith, and the investigation quickly stalled. Elaine and Loris Pearsons have since come forward regarding the alleged runaway note. Despite its obvious strange wording and contextual meaning of the word goodbye being a clear nod to Jalik saying farewell, the Pearsons argued that this note was a homework assignment. Stephen Kerr had informed them that when dropping off Jalik that he was being punished and that he was to write an apology note to the homeschool group. Upon learning this information, the note can be compellingly read in a way of an apology note. The contextual outlook of the goodbye can also be read in a way that puts forward the idea that Jalik knew he was no longer welcome in the school group and might have just been saying goodbye in that capacity. Of course, this would be complete conjecture as there's no way to definitively say when the note was written. Divides in the family led to the adoptive grandmother of Jalik, Barbara Reilly, the mother of Jocelyn MacDonald, to side with the police investigation's theory that Kerr had something to do with Jalik's disappearance. And as the days and subsequent weeks turned to months, Jalik being found alive was becoming less and less likely. During this time, tips and sightings would continuously come in, with investigators following each and every one, stretching into states like Vermont. One tip came in the form of an anonymous letter sent into media outlets, and not police directly said, quote, "Jalik's still alive, needed a foot soldier for this war on drugs. Picked him up Route 40 post 30. He's okay, no fake. He says ask his mama and papa, who are the Macaroni family? My cat named Diamond. Why does Franti yell fire? Don't try to look, we are not there." End quote. This letter did have some intimate knowledge of Jalik, as he did in fact have a cat named Diamond, but the other mentions had no relevance to authorities, and while police tried to track down the origins of the letter, they quickly hit a dead end, as there was no return address and just a postmark of Westchester, New York. Police seized Kerr's computer and printer to try and prove he wrote the letter, but were unsuccessful. In 2008, Barbara Reilly went into the home of Kerr and MacDonald, where she broke in. Her aim was to find any evidence at all she could use during her ongoing custody battle for Jalik. While there, Barbara discovered something incredibly significant, Jalik's yellow fleece, the same fleece he was reported to be last seen in. Neighbours soon rang Kerr and family, who after 4 months of Jalik's disappearance, subsequently moved to West Rupert, Vermont. The neighbours let them know that Reilly was breaking in, and police were called. However, Reilly told them what she had found, and after signing an affidavit, police executed a search warrant and confirmed what Reilly had discovered. Kerr and MacDonald's family lawyer claimed the family were delighted, as it gave the hope that Jalik was still alive. Barbara is not accused of theft, but faces felony charges for burglary. Reilly's attorney, Greg Kalukas, said, quote, "Between now and then, the DA will take a good hard look at this case and hopefully come to a just conclusion. My heart breaks for her every day. She is such a sweet person who just wants to know what happened to her grandchild, no more or less than anyone else whose loved one goes missing," end quote. In 2012, 5 years after Jalik's disappearance, the State Police Major Crimes Unit held a press conference in which they announced the nature of the investigation would be a presumed homicide, with Gloria Coppola stating, "It is not a runaway, it is a presumed homicide."
Thank you, Chris. It has been 5 years since 12-year-old Jalik Rainwalker disappeared, and tonight, police tell us they're no longer searching for a missing boy. They believe he's dead. The Cambridge-Greenwich police chief says the status of this case has been changed to a probable child homicide, and they want to speak with Jalik's adopted father, who was the last person to see the boy alive. Jennifer Lukey has more on the case from Cambridge tonight.
While they would not reveal any official suspects, they did stress that they had zero cooperation from Jalik's parents. Jalik L. Rainwalker was last seen on November 1st wearing a bright yellow fleece pullover a grey t-shirt with a dragon image on the front, blue jeans and black high top runners. He was 12 years old, was 5 foot and 6 inches long, and weighed approximately 105 pounds. He was classed as biracial, with brown hair in a 2-inch afro with blonde highlights, with green eyes. If you have any information that might aid investigations, please contact the Greenwich Village Police Department at 518-692-9332. Theories and conclusions. There are two main theories in this case, which divide down in the middle, those who claim to love Jalik and those who did in fact love him. The actions of those who claim to love Jalik approach his search in very bizarre ways, with some reporting that Kerr attended vigils of Jalik selling eggs and speaking more about Martin Luther King than his son. In this next audio clip, you will hear Stephen Kerr react as a journalist inquires about his support of Martin Luther King.
Police say it is Stephen's own behavior that has led to suspicions, like during a recent vigil for Jalik when Stephen sold eggs and spoke more about Martin Luther King Jr. than his son.
I know that you're very passionate about Martin Luther King.
No, I'm very passionate about my son. And you know what? If you can't rely on people you call your heroes when the time is tough, who do you rely on? News media? Jerry Springer?
Stephen says he has nothing to do with Jalik's disappearance and has committed his life to take care of troubled children.
They believe Jalik ran away, and they support this with the goodbye note and the anonymous letter sent to media. When asked why he may have run away, they wanted to get to know his African-American roots and left to find a family with the same heritage as him. There is no evidence to support this. The family moved 4 months after Jalik went missing, changed numbers, and have evaded police. They, in the police's eyes, have never cooperated with law enforcement. In this next audio clip, you'll hear how Jocelyn McDonald feels they've been treated by police.
They say his parents are being uncooperative. Stephen has refused a polygraph test and to also offer up his DNA. Jalik's parents say it's because the police have been accusatory from the start.
They were asking him questions which are totally inappropriate, like, oh, so you watched a porn movie with your son and you had sex with him and then you hit him on the head and dropped him in a ditch. Just tell us where the ditch is.
Police say it is Stephen's own behavior that has led...
Those who love Jalik banded together. The Shones, the Pearsons, and Jalik's adoptive grandparents formed a task force, followed up investigations, pooled together a $25,000 reward for information. Barbara really even risked her liberty with breaking and entering to try and get any proof she could that could aid in investigations. They have talked exhaustively with media to keep Jalik's story alive, try drum up tips, every avenue they could pursue, they pursued it. They have only one theory, and that theory is that Kerr knows more than he has claimed, and at worst may have even been involved in Jalik's murder. Either outcome does not bode well for Jalik's safety or survival. With no cash, appropriate clothes for weather, and even basic needs like food or water, how could have Jalik survived all these years unaided? Is it possible he ran away? Of course, anything is possible. But is it probable? Sadly, investigators' opinion that Jalik is no longer with us and he may be the victim of foul play appears to be the strongest. I've never heard of a runaway situation where a person would write a runaway note but also make their bed up to look like somebody was sleeping in it. This is just one of the many things that bothers me about Jalik's disappearance. Also, like the duffel bag and stuffed animal that Jalik supposedly taken from the house being found in the garage, why would Jalik go as far as to decide to run away but not pack necessities like clothes? Even when I was younger and I was going to quote-unquote run away, I packed a bag. Badly, I might add, but I still knew that if I was going to make it in the world beyond, I needed provisions. And Jalik has stated as being highly intelligent. He would have known this. So let us just forget all these things for a second and just think he did run away with no belongings. Would he have gotten very far with no money? I highly doubt that buses would let a 12-year-old boy onto their bus at night or early morning with no money. They would think he was up to no good. So how far would he have gotten? A mile? Two? But none of these traces have been found by the police as they searched the surrounding woods that encompass Stephen Kerr's parents' house. Remember, they used tracker dogs, infrared cameras, and even they were on horseback. I'm sure they were only a few hours behind Jalik. How far could he have really gotten with all this police attention on his trail? The fact that in all these years not a tangible trace of Jalik's physical whereabouts is disturbing and can only really lead a logical mind to one conclusion. There is evidence to show Stephen Kerr was less than stable himself and that he had anger management problems. A particular situation recounted by Barbara Reilly says that one day Jalik was misbehaving, doing something repetitive that Kerr was giving out about. As Jalik persisted, Kerr proceeded to grab Jalik, drag him out to a nearby creek, and dunk the boy's head into it repeatedly. It is said if Jocelyn had not stepped in, who could tell where the violence could have led? A lot of this is compounded by Jalik's own issues. Yes, he had problems, but what person on this planet doesn't? Jalik was placed in therapeutic care for a reason. He was supposed to be in a stable, living environment where he could be nurtured and grow. But how can a boy on the precipice of puberty, who had a condition that made it very hard for him to make connections, suddenly be thrust into a situation where he sleeps, eats, and lives in a confined space, be expected to grow? That's what McDonald's and Kerr's home was. It was a cabin, with only two rooms, all the family lumped into this tight, socially draining environment. It would almost be, to me, a melting pot waiting to boil over. Jalik needed so much more help and care than what he was provided with, and Kerr and McDonald did not seem to be able to provide it. There is evidence that Kerr and McDonald received $1,500 per month for caring for Jalik, and that they continued to take this even while he was missing. It is very hard to imagine justice can be gotten here. With a Berlin Wall of silence built by Kerr, lack of physical evidence of murder and no body. But there have been cases prosecuted before in the United States with even less, so one has to hope. Hope that one day, Jalik, who has failed so many times by those that were supposed to care for him, receives justice finally, and that those who loved him so dearly can get the peace and knowledge of closure.
For Jalik's grandparents, hearing the word homicide is horrifying.
This is really hard. I mean, we want closure. We need closure. But, you know, it's been 5 years, and it's another holiday season, and it makes it really hard.
The 12-year-old was last seen with his father, Stephen Kerr, having dinner at a restaurant in Latham. The next day, he was reported missing. Investigators say there is no indication or evidence that Jalik ran away. They believe he was killed. In the days following his son's disappearance, Stephen Kerr said this.
I believe deep in my soul that my son Jalik is alive and safe somewhere.
But weeks later, he moved his family to Vermont and stopped cooperating with police.
If you did nothing wrong, if you have nothing to hide, why don't you cooperate with law enforcement to help find your son?
The Cambridge police chief stopped short of calling Kerr an official suspect.
I'm hoping that after the 5 years that they'll be able to come and answer some questions.
Police have found the jacket that Jalik was reported to have been wearing the day he disappeared, but they won't say where or when they located it. CBS 6 has also learned that cadaver dogs were brought in to search a building in Troy on Tuesday.
This is not a cold case. The leads have been coming in. We're at, you know, 500 and some odd leads in this case. This is just something that came up recently that we felt we had to thoroughly investigate.
While the questions continue about what happened to Jalik, his grandparents, who no longer have contact with their daughter, son-in-law, or other grandkids, hope that someone will come forward with new information. Jalik's grandparents have decorated this holiday tree for him here in Greenwich, and they say while all of the holidays have been difficult since he's been gone, this one will be the hardest.
We drove by cemeteries, and my heart was breaking because there are markers for people. There's no marker for our grandson. We just want a marker. We want to know where he is and what happened to him.
In Cambridge, Jennifer Lukey, CBS 6 News.
The Cambridge Greenwich Police Department is asking anyone who might have any information at all that could help this case to give them a call right away.